I ask myself, how many decisions do I make on the aesthetic level? Because I like to do it. I like to go someplace. I like to go to Holden Village, and Nora likes it even better than I, just about. And so I never ask whether it's right or wrong. Good. Besides, the pressure comes from old man, the old man of the woods, so I yield and come to Holden Village, never really having asked, is it right or is it wrong? Well, let's say that the Lord does help us along in the life of sanctification, so that we're not always doing what we don't want to do. That's the test of whether we're doing for the Lord. But that oftentimes what he has put it in our hearts to want to do, he also asks us to do. And Kierkegaard at one time said, the Christian life is something like marriage, or like the marriage service. He said it's a contradiction. Here are two people who fall in love. They want more than anything else in the world to honor and cherish each other. And then the church has their very indelicate and strange habit of ushering them up into a public situation and demanding that they do what they want to do. You know, it doesn't add up. It's like when my boys were little, if one of the boys had wanted a bicycle and I didn't think he was old enough, and I said, no, you can't have a bicycle for some time yet, and then I should change my mind. And all the while, he's been going down and looking in the store window at bicycles and just longing to have a bicycle. And then one day I call him aside and I say, Andrew, don't say anything against me. Now I'm going to tell you, you've got to have a bicycle. Now, what would he say? He'd say, what's happened to this man? and probably be scared to take a bicycle under those circumstances for fear that... But Kierkegaard says that's what the Christian life is. That's which, out of gratitude to God, you want to do, and you've got to do. The two come together in some way. Richard?
What is the difference in the nature of self? If Kierkegaard did not have a self because he was compelled, he was driven by these things outside of his own will, as one who is in Christ, we are, it seems, also driven, also compelled. What is then the definition of our self in Christ?
I wouldn't quite be able to answer, I don't think. That's puzzled me too, that Christ in us, that as Christ dwells within me, it is no longer I, but Christ, you know.
But he does deal with this under a category. He differs between a religion A, in which you come into this realization of grace, but you're still central to it, to religion B, where it becomes the sovereign grace of God in the living Christ, who now becomes the center of the self and who directs it. And interesting enough, this is what he writes his first book without using one of his peculiar kinds of, what do we call them again? Anticlimactus and so on. What do we call those again?
What?
Pseudonyms? Pseudonyms, yeah. Mm-hmm. So these pseudonyms, then he writes in his own name. Peculiarly enough, published in 46, before he himself realized in his own life the living Christ, which hit him in the Easter service of 48. And then he writes, interesting enough, in his journal, now I could have married a girl. Now I would not have had to live my life as an exception. Very, very interesting. And then he's drawn into this direct conflict situation with the church after that. But that's where he himself came into it. Where it's Christ himself and his living presence who creates this continual miracle of the triangle. Christ, myself, and the neighbor. Because he's doing it. He's the one who makes you a neighbor. And not someone who's simply over against me or with whom I'm competing, or somebody I ignore or exploit, but a person, a neighbor.
That would be Pauline then also then.
Yeah. This is where he comes into this. Yeah. When you come in the slave of Christ, he continually creates this triangular situation in life and makes my wife a neighbor, my children a neighbor, and so on. He puts this depth relationship into all persons. It becomes persons, you see. No, to use Turnier's angle here. That's where he becomes so exciting in works of love, which is still central to the ethical debate within the Lutheran Church as well as within the whole Church. This is the side of Kierkegaard that Barth didn't see, because these other writings of Kierkegaard are in German, but the mature writings of Kierkegaard got in later, and Barth somehow didn't see that side of it.
Can one say then that an aesthetic self then would be sort of parenthetic? I mean, within the bounds of the limits of individual, whereas religious self is open and free then to relate with neighbors, to serve.
He deals with this actually in some of his fun illustrations, like, shall I hire a carriage and a horse and go for a ride? No, in relationship to the living Christ, what becomes of this? No, that pure pleasure aspect remains. That's part of your total humanity. And so you do. You go out and you smoke a good cigar at that nice cafe out there, and so on. This is part of your affirmation of life under your true selfhood from Jesus Christ. You have this freedom again to be.
And then, of course, I try to remember that I still am a, though I have reached the stage of forgiveness and reconciliation, the old Adam is kicking around with all his vigor, you know, and so I stand in terror that I'm this aesthetic creature, and I'm the old ethical man trying desperately to justify myself and being condemned, and ought to stand in terror of the law. And when somebody has veered over into the third category and forgotten that, then you've got this, eternal security. You don't sin anymore.
You blow it. Hmm. But on the other side, what he still deals with that's very much so, and his questions he directs there, and that's just become part of his own very clear writing this one. Because for him, the problem was indirection, literary versus direct witness. So he was a literary person without authority, only to relate with this beautiful literary gift of his in terms of indirection. But now what happens to that is he permitted this. Is that simply to go back to live the ascetic? And this is his problem in the last years of his life, mm-hmm. always. That's where he writes these sermons. He doesn't have any place to preach them, but he writes them. Mm-hmm. They're tremendous. For he's a direct witness. But he still speaks of himself in irony, that I am a man without authority. One of his brief little things to that is finally in English, that I wish had come in earlier, because it deals with the difference between a genius and an apostle. A genius is permitted in direction, an apostle has to be a witness. And the need of being a witness. Then once you're a witness, you're a martyr. Now you're a sufferer. Before he could hide behind his pseudonyms in a real sense, which he did. He played games with the Danes. None of these books sold more than about 500-600, and he had to pay his own, put out his own money to publish them. They didn't sell. I mean, they sold by the millions now in this generation, yeah. But he didn't collect any of those royalties. But that was his fundamental. Should I now take a call to a parish? This became a real conflict situation for him. Should I now take a call and not write anymore? You see, in response to your question. But I have to be who I am. This still hit him, and this is my particular calling. He felt, and he wrote two different essays twice in his life on my point of view as an author. He tries to explain this whole thing, both for his future readers, because he's always writing to that individual to come, as well as for the contemporary world. He felt he'd answered every kind of a point of view a person can take with Christianity from every point that he could take it. He actually did this, except for our modern 20th century scientific point of view. Although, interesting enough, these scientists in Denmark that I had the chance to associate with, because this embassy would call me down whenever the meeting, Niels Bohr and his gang, you know, and they said they read Kierkegaard to go to sleep on. That was their final moment of every day. They felt this keen about him in terms of the answer to themselves, as the fellows who produced the atomic bomb. You know, imagine what kind of thing they were going through, and how he helped them over that to this area of forgiveness. Is over against what for them was pure aesthetic kind of pleasure. A guy carrying on his experiences and stumbling on the atom and the picture of it and driving through this other stuff. So it's interesting for them, for this is a very real issue.
or do you enter into the area of suffering for it? Now you have to not only say, well, I produced the atom bomb, but you've got to suffer about it. Niels Bohr spent all his last years running around on this two-true theory. We talked about that all over Europe, that if it takes two theories for light, it certainly, and that's simply a physical phenomenon, how much more for life it takes two statements. Deals with the same thing.
Now, I remember Swenson saying that, or maybe I read it, where in his house where he lived, where Kierkegaard lived, in his father's house, I guess it was his father's house, wasn't it? He'd have the desk waist high in every single room, and it was his custom to be walking around a good deal in the house, but he didn't want to risk losing an idea or by having to go to the next room and sitting and getting a pencil and writing it down. So he had in every room, he had a desk waist high, so he's all ready to get it down the moment it struck him.
And he put out, at one time, put out three of these books at one time. Three of them that are essentially fantastic till it's out. Like the whole nature of anxiety that he discusses, that still is the basis for all psychiatry at this point. And when does anxiety actually become sin, or when is it simply the human situation? That whole side of him is exciting.
Well, I don't think I'd like to have had him on my church board. I wouldn't have cared to have had Paul either. Or Luther.
What he's continually driving for is, I think, the essential concern of all of us who are born Lutheran and bred within the tradition, and that is, how can you make first-generation Christians out of second-generation ones? Really, this is the fundamental issue for all of us, and this is what he continually addresses himself to. How do you make martyrs out of an audience?
I remember his saying about the church in Denmark, you know, they say about that at that time, like we talk about this relativism today, that there's neither black nor white, it's all sort of contextual ethics in the middle somewhere, and the gray matters. He said, after that, I go home and go to the Old Testament and to Shakespeare, where they sinned with gusto, and there were virile sinners. And, Macbeth, Othello, you know, there you see what sin really does. What, with Othello, was it Iago who was the sinner? No, he was just the catalyst. It was Othello. And what was the sin? The sin was distrust. That was it. He takes that sin of distrust, which normally everybody says, well, doesn't everybody, isn't everybody suspicious of everybody? What's so bad about that? But Shakespeare gets it into its lurid dimensions, what it does. Finally, it kills Desdemona and kills himself. And it wasn't murder, it was distrust or suspicion. That was it.
The image actually that he uses here that changes in response to the question that Rich Kamer has asked is, in his earlier writings, he sees the Knight of Faith as essentially anonymous. He's masked. He's with you, he's carrying on his work, he goes to his bank if he's a banker, or he goes to his office if he's a clerk. He's a Knight of Faith, but he's always anonymous. You are not immediately aware of him. He is, in other words, an indirect kind of a witness to the epiphany of God in his task in himself, but it's never something obvious. And this is what he develops in the early part of writing. Then after this hits him so strongly, the living Christ one, he moves from that into where you have to be a martyr. You have to be a witness for which you are actually being kicked around. And this is the latter writings that he gets into. We have a direct conflict situation constantly evolved. And I think what in all of our lives we've seen something of this. You can go along for a long time being accepted, but then suddenly you come to that decision point where you can't simply be a knight of faith, it's anonymous. You've got to speak up. Yeah. Something is cruel in this situation, it's destroying, and then you've got to speak to it.
Now we're sitting here admiring and being stimulated by what controversy and so forth Kierkegaard brought up in his lifetime.
This was cleverly done at the American, at the convention, the American Psychologist, just now, by Robert Coles, who came in walking hunchback and acted the part of Kierkegaard. And of course, he says, what you'd all do is put me in a cell. You wouldn't want to hear what I have to say. You wouldn't let me speak.
Well, we'd put on a dinner for him here, I think.
I think we could celebrate him. In a crazy way, Muggeridge is trying to carry this through right now.
Mm-hmm.
And like I told my phone to him, we'd celebrate him. But you do become a very difficult and rather nasty kind of person. You aren't saying nice things about people. See? And this is what crashes through. It isn't something being nice, fine, decent chaps. See?
No.
Everything in our English-speaking tradition sort of has the idea that finally what happens in relation to Jesus Christ, you become a gentleman. Rather a nice guy. Tell him to trust his wife with you. That sort of thing. He'll trust your bank account soon. But he really doesn't. Hurt either. He isn't hurt. Mm-hmm. And it's sharing a hurt that I think is the issue here with the Kierkegaard. But he's trying to get through, and that he tries in those last strenuous years to carry through. And he does it by making himself an example in reverse in some ways. But that you are hurting. And this is where Christ is found, where the hurt is.
But I think he never, and that's why he called himself a corrective tool. He never really got jubilant about the gospel, about his freedom, that is, about the joy, I don't think he did.
Well, he had no community. He had no community. This is the tragedy. He didn't have a community.
Mm-hmm.
You read Bishop Minster when he attacks at the end, and really the finest little study of Galatians, I think, done for popular use of his. It's a beautiful thing. And he felt him as a beautiful person, his father's hero. But again, using Christianity as something to preach about rather than something to suffer with, you see. And this is the sort of category of suffering that I think is quite essential that we hear.
Well, he's hard on preachers and professors.
Professor.
He said, is it possible that a professor can get into the kingdom? And he said, no. With man it would be impossible, but with God all things are possible.
Well, because a professor is always in doubt but never in error. And he pointed just the other way around, like Lever Enriquez here. You've got to be never in doubt but always in error. And he speaks of the blessedness of always being in error before God. It's impossible to act without sin, but you've got to act. Because that's your calling. And then you're hurting for the kind of world that we're in, which is simply a broken world. Not in tune with God. And if you're trying to live in tune with God, you're going to be hurting, and you're going to get hurt. And that's where he is, a wonderful corrective till this hour. And also, I think Muggeridge is right in seeing that in his refusal to see a community resolution of it, he's essentially right still. You can't get out of this. I remember one fellow in prison camp with me, Father Barter, who read a good deal of Kierkegaard, and finally said, what he didn't see was worship. Worship is discipleship. Well, that's too easy enough. Or that the concern for your community is to become a bureaucrat handing out money that the taxpayers pay. No, this isn't a possible resolution of the issue. So neither liberal nor conservatives are at peace with the guy. One quote I've used on this, one issue that Al mentions in his journal, it's a beautiful one, and it's essentially true on the basic issues that each of us have to confront about ourselves. A hint is a possibility from God. One must follow it. To do so and to fail, that's in God's hand. Not to do so, that's a torment in all eternity. And there's a central issue here that he hits, you see, and so we can read the signs. None of us are so stupid we can't read our own signs. And if your refusal to follow the hint is because the dogs are barking, see? And they're bigger than you are. And they always are. They always seem to be. Because finally, again, there's just one of you. There's no pattern. There are no rules. And that's a very fearful thing. See? So you back out of it and say, no, it's not necessary. My country, right or wrong. Not my country, right and wrong. The president knows best. It's not for me to delve with these things. I just got to follow orders.
That's the Nazi picture finally out of it. But that's our, we sanctified that root away from discipleship as a Lutheran church. And it's wrong. We know it's wrong. I mean, every person knows when he has, we see, well, like he says so simply, all I desire is honesty, simple human honesty.
I think we who are in the business of words are especially uneasy with Kierkegaard, because it's the doing of his will and not talking about it. And yet, and he's got this well-known parable of the tame geese, that the geese got together on every Sunday morning, and one of the ganders would get up and speak about what glorious creatures the geese were. They had been given the gift of wings to fly to great climes and see great heights and do great things. And every time he said that, the geese would curtsy at the right place, you know, in the proper liturgy. And then he said, and then when the service was over, they'd all waddle back home, fat and sleek, because they were prosperous. Then he said, and once there was a young goose who took this seriously, and he began to become thin, and he wasn't prospering. And the other geese there said, there you see what happens if you take this too seriously. You're not going to prosper like if you do it properly. It reminds me of Friedrich Nietzsche's Zarathustra on how to sleep well, on rules to sleep well. If you want to sleep well, you got to work 8 hours a day, because then you get tired and you can sleep well. Then you got to play some to relax to sleep well. And then you have to observe the virtues to sleep well. You can't commit adultery and kill. And you've got to observe the virtues to sleep well, otherwise you'll be awake. And just one more thing, however, you must put the virtues themselves to sleep at the right time, or you won't sleep well.
Another one of Kierkegaard's illustrations, themes I love very much, is this fellow who blocked the king's horses. And then he drove them the way the horses wanted to go. And pretty soon, instead of that sprightly step and that, you know, sense of bounce down the street, they were going down the street like horses would go, just in their own mediocre fashion. And it was a dismal sight to look upon, and hardly like the king's horses had been. But then the king's coachman took them over once more, and they again went down the street like the king's horses. Which is pretty much the way he came out. Now there you have it. The king, one Jesus Christ, who knows that you are sons and daughters of God and not simply what has finally been fashioned out of apes, you've got to bounce. You've got to walk down that, as those who own the world, pennilessly own the world. And something new happens because you're new. And you are new. It can't be the same. But can it happen? Can a Colson be real? You know, all the arguments that's been going in the papers right now. Can a guy actually, that's the most reprehensible and most disliked of everybody in Nixon's gang, come out of this clean, you know, actually be a son of God? We don't even like him. An embarrassment, he calls himself a Christian. I remember some of us from Washington at that time were a great guy. He said, this is embarrassment to all Christian church. A guy like that should become a Christian. The bearded people with long hair want to be related to Jesus Christ instead of us fine fellows that keep up your appearances. It's the joy of the relationship with the living Christ that he does see, but he never really allows to happen to him. He feels that he has to carry out the final thing of being himself an example of the desperation of this hour. Because it is a desperate hour. I mean, he has the gift of wisdom to see that this goes on, and you get what we collected out of it in the 20th century. He saw our boredom as being that which man couldn't bear, which would visit him with horrible wars and such cruelty from man to man as the world has rarely seen. And we've seen it. I mean, he's right. As a prophet, he's right on target all the time. Because man can't bear this boredom of living a mediocre, tedious life of saying I'm a good man, I bring home the bacon, I take care of my wife and children. What more do you expect? Remember, funny thing in this light, Swenson had Howard Hong take as one of his little researches for his philosophy from him, just ask people in Minneapolis for a period of a week or two, what are you living for? One guy hit Howard, another one spit at him, and the answer was, well, obviously what I'm living for. Make a buck. What do you think? They were being called to be something more, and they refused to face that, even in the question, what are you living for? They knew better. But can you expect in this kind of a world it can be any different? And so all you settle for is cynicism, finally, and boredom. Because you failed your own heavenly vision. Like Melanchthon cries out in the confession, the tragedy of man is expects so little. And really, Kierkegaard addresses that. Man is this tremendous, fearsome creature that is himself a peculiar kind of combination of the infinite and the finite, which the incarnation itself gives us a reflection to see. He's more than a wage-earning kind of a creature, or a social being who takes care of the mores that create a safe and sane society. He was made with some kind of wings to fly. And when he doesn't use them, he is a pathetic person just ready for the button maker again, the goose that are being fattened for the feast. And it's that image that carries him and sustains him through it all. It's the great image he sees of man, because he has been taken captive by God and Jesus Christ as the image for man. And he's this hunchback guy with his own peculiar kind of ambling gait that the Corsair, the Mad Magazine of Denmark, continually caricatures and makes fun of. And what happens to, like, Ibsen saw enough of it to write two great plays, but he never dared come through himself on it. Bjornson capitulates entirely to the famous Jewish literary critic of Denmark, Brandes, and gives up his whole Christian point of view. And he sees this is happening. If that's happening at that level, it's going to happen all the way through. What you've got is a society that's sold off. And you can't live for that kind of a petty image of yourself or each other. Finally, there's no ecstasy, because there's no agony. Just making a living again, making a buck. And this is why I find him so refreshing always when I turn to him. He always restores for me something of, what are you after? What's your goal? What do you want out of Holden Village? This is what he'd ask. Are we going to be a cozy cult up here, putting puzzles together and playing games? Or are you hurting?
Yeah. I think as Peer Gynt was a great picture of the aesthetic, Brand is equally a great picture of the ethical, not getting out of the ethical, where he always tries to do what's right and abstain from what's wrong in a grim, persistent way. And finally, his world falls apart, and in the last scene where he stands there, this pathetic figure, he's ruined his family, he's ruined everything by this ethical category and not escaping it or not getting out of it. And then he hears the avalanche coming down, and in the booming of the avalanche, he hears the words, Deus caritas, God is grace. You know, you didn't make it by your ethical business. The gap is still there.
Enemies of the people the same way. It's this guy who is honest with that resort situation, but he finally only ends up sort of celebrating his own being out of step. I am alone. And that's no resolution for a man either. It's interesting in these kind of almost caricatures out of Kierkegaard that Ibsen wrote.
Well, it's a shame if they tried to discredit him by saying that he was crazy, you know. If what they did was Nietzsche, and a lot of stuff Nietzsche did was awfully good. On the other side, however. this is a good classroom.
Neat. Any questions you'd like to ask now, address them. You've got Al here, who's spent his life with this and has lived it out in his own kind of calling as well.
But I must say that, I have these 3 years of theology at our seminary, very, very good theology with faithful to the confessions and the scriptures and largely, of course, to the 17th century. But under Swenson and Kierkegaard, most of that came alive. I saw as the bones got flesh.
This is part of what Barth called his revival. He called Kierkegaard his prophet, his theologian. Then he mentions from Jeremiah to Paul to Augustine to Luther, Calvin, Kierkegaard. He mentions those six being it. And yet, when he wrote his first book in theology, he finally threw it all away and started over again, because he felt Kierkegaard had misled him by beginning on a humanist level, which is where Kierkegaard, all of his pseudonyms are. They all are on the level of humanism, outside of revelation. That he himself did not live at that level at all is extremely clear in this Barth myth. And then when Barth carries through the war, he finally sees the whole resolution in the living Christ and the relationship to him that the forgiveness of sins allows, so something new happens. There he and the later Kierkegaard are really speaking in one language. They are identical as the kind of resolution to this terrible boredom, and out of that boredom, the kind of cruelty that we visit on each other. And the insipidity of living a life that finally is just gossip, just being echoes of each other. And that's where he reclaims man for his destiny as God's created sons and daughters. Didn't do so well on the daughters. He felt maybe women and children should be exempted from this life of reflection. They're not being quite, up to it.
They're the poets of the world. I suppose that's what he thought.
Yeah. When we came to our seminary, one of our profs, the rest of them were all telling us what a good time we had there and so on. This prof, his name is Jacob Tanner, he taught till he was 97. And he wasn't allowed to teach seminary that long, but he kept teaching at Waldorf after he was at the seminary. But he's a very stocky guy, very powerfully muscular built, and he put his foot up on the radiator and looked at this guy a little bit and stroked his beard, kept looking at us, and everybody else had been hoping he would have a nice time at the seminary. If he had any problems, of course, they could come to them, but we'd grow more if we solved them ourselves and didn't bother them with it. And he just looked at us some more and he says, you know, all I wish for you while you're here, agony and more agony. In proportion as you are in anguish here, you can help people when you're through. Well, that's Kierkegaard speaking. That was that note. And he's in that, and that's the Socratic tradition. The unreflected life is not worth living, that's Socrates. But where Kierkegaard saw Socrates so well, he saw the exhaustion of the ethical. This is why Nietzsche hates him and Kierkegaard loves him. See, Nietzsche thought you could actually carry the ethical through, and this is where he still stays. But Socrates is clear. He says, I'm a monster, no man. And for that remark, Nietzsche called him an afterbirth. Because he sold out man. In other words, delivered him over to the gods. And this is where Kierkegaard used him. He saw that man on his own could only see his own bankruptcy. And that's where he helped Barth so much, because Barth was bankrupt. He said, there was Saturday night, stop and wheel. I had nothing to preach to my people on Sunday morning, country church. Fortunately, he said, small enough church, so I wasn't kept so busy, but what I knew, I was bankrupt. Two of the great spirits in our century had the same kind of an experience on Saturday night, the other one being Archbishop Soderblom. The same thing happened to him. He called in the maid. How would you preach on this text? And from her, discovered the happy exchange. This is where Kierkegaard really has helped to feed our century, I think, very much. For he's exciting, you see, so you've got this whole other stream of atheistic existentialism. It's because the fellow writes so well that you can't help but read him. Nobody has to be told you have to read Kierkegaard. If you start reading him, you're going to read him. He simply writes that well, you can't keep from reading. Although, peculiar enough, I'm just because of my own sticks, I have never read either or.
as everybody else has.
That's usually what they begin. Howard Hong's father, for instance, a banker, boy from Norway, carries that book in his pocket. That's his lifelong volume. And that's what makes Howie our Kierkegaard, because his dad was never without that volume around.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Because he's never, I don't know Danish well enough, but was it some literary critic who said that there's nobody who's ever used the Danish language as this man has, where language fits thought and emotion and everything else as a glove fits a hand. Just right.
But it even comes out in English, you see, because you always get this whimsy and irony and humor again, that just over and over again, he just catches you off guard. Well, he was alone. He just plain was a loner. He was really alone. And he writes to that individual again who is alone. He finds his, he really finds his communication in that anonymous reader that's to come that will read him. And the nice thing about it is it sort of catches you when you read. You become that reader for him. Mm-hmm. You become that individual for whom he exists and whom he writes. And he really gives you support. I know of no writer who gives me so much support in the kind of particular calling that's been mine to be me. No. And I didn't ask to be up here at Holden Village. I didn't.
But I think the tension between resting back in the grace of God and then being caught in the imperatives of the disciple of love is interwoven so well that the reader doesn't have to be melancholy. I think he had to be, but
he never
I think the reader had to be.
One of his diaphthongs are very good on this. The poet is told to write. What he is asked to do is suffer.
Mm-hmm.
For only as he suffers can he be the poet.
Mm-hmm.
So when the poet sings, it's because he has known the tears. That's what he said. And this comes in, I mean, anybody who has proclamation has something of that aspect in him. Hugh Dobie, for an example, comes here out of a suicide of his father and the desertion of his wife, and he's got a message, hasn't he? And we don't know what's gone into it, but we can hear the tear, and you listen, your ears are open to it, because he just isn't saying something that's mushy when he says God's after you and he won't let you go. And that's what Kierkegaard did out of that peculiar haunting specter of his father on his whole life that was there, because his father was this. And then his own relationship to it. Somehow, when you're in Denmark, you can understand and appreciate him more, where people are already rather lonely, where the suicide rate is one of the higher ones, I guess as high as any, in our civilized world, and where people build hedges between themselves and the next house, even so that what little chance they have to have a neighbor shut out because the hedges shut them out. And so you have this feeling of escape into total privacy, away from each other. It's really a strange feeling to have. And then, of course, Kierkegaard knew you for two other of the great Danish figures, both of them great in their own way, because they try to burst out of that feeling of isolation in his own way. Hosse Andersen with his fairy tale kind of approach, which Kierkegaard scorned and struck down his pure sentimentality, which it is, delightful sentimentality, but it is. Or that he felt another did with mythology, and in mythology enters into it, that's interesting. And so there's always been a real kind of contest in the Danish society between Grundtvig and Kierkegaard. And you go into the Royal Library, and Kierkegaard has a statue outside, but Grundtvig is at the entryway opening up the library so you can come in. It's between these two. And they're two of the great spirits that have visited our planet, without any question. And Kierkegaard's critique of Grundtvig did not exhaust Grundtvig by any means. Grundtvig is something very real to say to us. And it's in this realm of community, of fellowship, and of total celebration. There, Grundtvig was really on. Even though some of his hymns, I feel about them just like Kierkegaard did.
where's Jesus Christ in all this? Where, you know, he felt Grundtvig is a good example of religion A without allowing the specific concrete nature of Jesus Christ and his living fellowship with us to come through. So I like Per Lunning's book on him, though Per feels he didn't by any means get to the core of it, but on the contemporaneity of Jesus Christ as being the essential concern of Kierkegaard for all of us, that we know Jesus Christ as the eternal contemporary. Not about him, but know him. And that certainly is in the essence of it. Yeah, that's right. He was 23 when he wrote that out.
When you were talking about how the place was on the phone, how sure we have met that for so many. He writes out of the existence of this introduce us to that reality.
And he feels this is the universal. That's the universal he speaks to. And he speaks about this as being the universal. I mean, this, you as the individual, and you're truly the individual, are also the universal individual, the two me. Because there are no exceptions. For each of you is distinctly the creation of God, unique to you, and a loner, when you are true to yourself. So he speaks very much to that the sense of realizing the universal. You realize the universal when you are you. And that's why he can say, choose any commandment. He says, no, choose any commandment. I don't care which one you want to take. Choose any one and follow it. It'll lead you to this experience of bankruptcy and the need of the cross. And he exposes there this sort of blahness with which we deal with it. I'm okay. I never killed anybody, you know. I may have stamped a lot of people into the dirt, but gone past many as if they weren't there, and they felt they weren't there.
That's a lot of his melancholy, too.
Yeah.
I mean, this sense that there's a grief, a person can have a grief that people are so soon moved away, and that they can be moved away by that very grief. And that they are really in the grief.
And one category we didn't speak about here, which is very real for him all the way through, and that's the category of the absurd. And of course, that's been picked up in our whole contemporary drama, too.
Mm-hmm.
But that the essence of the absurd is, of course, that the eternal has a temporality.
Yeah.
That God has become flesh and dwelt amongst us. That's the essence of the absurd. And from there, you move on into this, the whole area of the realization of the absurd in life. Which creates both a category of irony and humor for him, finally. It makes him fun.
Wasn't there a period in the life of the Danish Church where theological students were prohibited from reading him?
Martensen, the Danish ethicist that he attacked afterwards, you know, that succeeded Minster, and he had no use for him at all. And that, of course, Martensen is in English and read still in ethics. This business of making a system. He had no use ever for the system. The system always destroys the individual. There is no system. There's no category of that way. The universal is you. You are the universal when you are realizing the truth is truth for you. Then you are truly universal. But when you try to become part of the system and make it a category which can be then outlined and given out systematically, he says that's eating the 500-foot tapeworm of the professor. And you're no longer confronted by the leap over the 50,000 fathoms. All you have to do is learn and hand it back again. And that, he saw, was what Europe has done, so it killed. It had killed life and livability. It had killed it, literally, when that happened. This is when I asked at Johann's College the night before he was going to be graduated, I asked his best teacher, who's now died. He's a very, very able teacher. I said, did you teach Johann yet? And he said, no. I said, well, if you can't teach Johann, you can't teach the black heathen. I said, no, you can't teach him. I said, who can you teach? Well, the New Englander. I said, well, because the New England one, then just analysis, you see, categories, you kill it, and then you learn it, and you hand it out again. He says, yep, that's what we do. We do that very well. And that's as great an undergraduate school as we have. But see, that's hardly, in that, Barth deals with that. That's not education. That's not drawing out. the uniqueness that you, which Barth says is what educate means in Latin, essentially. It's about the third or fourth derived meaning, actually, but it's one of them. And for that, Kierkegaard was fighting. So he's contending for the whole system of education and what happens to you in it. Which means, finally, it has to be one-to-one, doesn't it? Can you teach a class?
You know, that was a remarkable thing about Swenson. Since he was deaf, we couldn't dialogue in class because he had this big machine which was very hard to handle. So his lectures were all monologues, but they were so dialogical, you know, that every student was drawn in to be an individual and not part of the mass. He was a remarkable teacher.
And in your area, what he'd have, he had a great lecture on Christian art. And there's one Christian art, and that's the art of allowing people to mean the midwife to the person to break through to the living crisis. That's the only art there is. That's the Christian art. This was David Swenson on that one, which you'd buy 100%. I mean, this is where it is. And I know that's what Jacob Tanya said. That's the rarest gift in the ministry. It's so much easier to hand it off. Or like Almowit used to say, use the catechism as a gimmick. And they got the answers and they hand it back to them. But the only thing that always foils every pastor is always the dumbest kid that when the deacons were examining, at least for me, I always had the deacons examine. First they gave a dinner to them and I let the kids examine the deacons. And then publicly in confirmation, the deacons did the examination. There's always the dumbest of the kids who never had their lesson that could say when they asked what the gospel was, they didn't say the golden rule. They knew it was that we can't by our own reason or strength believe in Jesus Christ, but the Holy Spirit has called us through the gospel. So that always, fortunately, the system doesn't work. It breaks down. It breaks down to those that are too dumb to learn. Like when I was lecturing on marriage and sex here, and Dale said so very nicely to the Dale Tester, I'm glad I was so dumb that I never remembered any of those stupid things I was told. Like you're supposed to treat every girl like your mother or your sister. I was one of them.
I remember the end of the course in epistemology with Swenson, the question, how can you know that, he said, when you've exhausted all the powers of your reflection, and that's as far as you can go, then you have to change train. You have to take the train of faith. Because the end of reflection is awe or worship or wonder. And if you want to go on into that world, you have to abandon the train of reason and board another train. It's quite a significant way to end a course of study. Say, well, if you so far we can go, but now, if you want to go any further, you have to change things.
Yeah.
Could you turn the microphone around? We're not getting
it. You want this? That's tape. No, he was just saying about Swenson on that. And I was thinking, when they asked him, and they put in the General College at the University of Minnesota, and they asked him, what should we try to do with the General College? Is teach him to read. You see, and again they said, you know, ambiguities. Oh, no, teach him to read. That's what a university is supposed to do, teach him to read. Well, obviously, if you learn to read, you realize the end of reflection is that it won't make it. You can't reflect yourself in. You're finally where you got to be taken, where it is the leap of faith again. And it's because people haven't learned to read but just memorize and echo and give back what they've heard, they never come into that realm of reality. They stay outside as essential copies of each other, really.
You can get A's better that way, though. You know, to give it back.
Well, you take one of the teachers I have that thinks Swenson's the greatest teacher that ever hit America, and he just finished his teaching at Harvard, James Luther Adams, and he was furious because I didn't hand back his phrases in a paper. And I looked at him, and I just kind of laughed, and then he kind of blushed. Became a good friend after that. I didn't say any more. But this is that's the professor again. They should be excited that it causes you to reflect in your own train of thought. I mean, when in a sermon you haven't heard the end, it may have been the best sermon you've heard. You've already been allowing something along the line to really really sent you, and you're into something that you carry through with. You repeat the sermon back again, you maybe didn't even hear it. It's just, you know. And that's our Lord's parables. And this is really what he was meaning by his indirection and being a miuetic method, he takes this big word. It's midwifery. You can't give birth to anybody, but you can be in anguish over them till Christ is born in the manure, like Paul says. And that's all I am as a midwife. See, that was his whole point. And that was Socrates again, the same way.